And here's his first one. His first answer, this is terribly logical, he's quite a brilliant fellow, obviously. He firstly addresses married people who are Christians, both of them. So that's his first focus. And this is what he says, and you who are married can make what sense of, and please remember, Paul's not saying he's got the last word on it, in fact, to say that. But this is the best wisdom he's got on it. Because of the situations of sexual immorality, because there is sexual immorality among you, in other words, well, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Some of these people say we shouldn't be married, maybe we shouldn't be married, maybe we should be celibate, maybe we should be this. Yeah, well, hang on, he says. If you're living the purest of purest of purest of lives is one thing, but you're not. There are problems in the community in this matter. So the safest place for sexual life is going to be marriage, committed love. So get that straight first. If you're married in faith, well, that's the best thing to be. And be that. He goes on to say, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife doesn't have authority over her own body, the husband does. Likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement, for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this by way of concession, not command. I'm not telling you what to do. He's a celibate. He's not going to tell them how to live their married life. But he's saying this is, the word concession there is sung gnome, a coming together of minds. I say this, I want you to think about this and see what you think of it and ponder it. But really, that's his advice to them. By the way, the scholars tell me, that's extraordinarily rare. In fact, I don't know whether it's unique. I don't want to go that far. But in the moral writing of the time, nobody takes the woman's point of view. I mean, that's quite sensitive to the woman, isn't it? It's looking at it from the woman's point of view as well, which is remarkable. You'd expect it. But in those days, you don't find it, except in this lovely man. So that's his advice to the married people. So if they're saying, to be Christian, do I have to be somebody saying, no, you don't. You're married, you've committed yourself in love, stay in the marriage, love each other and be very careful, you know, and all that. So there's the first qualification. And here's his principle. It's a beautiful one. I wish that all were as I myself am. He's celibate. I wish you were all like that. That's what I'd like, he says. But each has a particular gift from God. There's the key. One having one kind and one a different kind. So that is the ultimate principle. What is God's will for you, for me? How can you best love? How can I best love? What graces do we have by nature? How do you learn to love best? And obviously the vast majority of the world are going to learn to love best by having a sexual partner. That's so obvious it needs to be said. But if you have to look at your own gifts. Now, as a celibate, that strikes me as wise, but you could say wiser things, but it doesn't strike me as being not sensible. Then, having said I'd like you to be like me, meaning Paul, he then briefly he talks to those who are like him, unmarried, and he has this bit of advice. To the unmarried and the widows, and we're not sure what Paul is, which of those, but to those who aren't in a sexual relationship, I say that it's well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they're not practicing self-control, they should marry. It's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. In Paul's defense, it's very important to realize that he is not doing a treatise on marriage. That's not his aim. He's not saying all the wonderful things there are about marriage. He is answering a question that he's been asked, and he's simply attending to the question. So married people, no, if you're married, be married, and only step back from that relationship by mutual consent and for a little time and all that. If you're not married, well, then I think that's a good way to say, but you better watch it, because if you can't love as an unmarried person, if you find yourself caught up in passion and not handling it well, and you're going off to the temple prostitute or whatever, if that's your behaviour, well, you'd be much better to not be celibate, because you're not celibate. It's a special way of loving. So combine, work at finding relationship where you can live your life and learn to love properly and stop this highfalutin kind of stuff. Paul's words on celibacy cause him to turn his attention for a moment to those who are in a position to follow his example, those who've never married, as well as widowers and widows. He suggests that they think seriously about celibacy, but only if they have the gift. It's no good attempting celibacy unless they can live a sexually moral life and can mature in love as a celibate. If they do not have the gift, because actually all of us, we're simply called to love. Well, if you can't love as a celibate, for God's sake, don't do it. If they don't have that gift, let them marry, since it gives them a way of expressing their sexual needs. It's a much safer way to live a chaste life. Guess that's obvious. So I thought I'd say a few words to you, because obviously I have to think about it a lot. And now I talk about something I do know a little bit about, I guess. But I will be brief. I just got two pages on it. Try and share with you some thoughts on celibacy, because however well they are. This is as I see it from my study and life and all that. If we're going to become mature, if I'm going to mature as a human being, and I'm not going to put a measure on that, when you're speaking in public, I fully realise you give a hell of a lot away. So I presume you've got a fair idea of how immature I am or mature. I'll leave that to you to work out. But so without making... Just if I'm going to... I, as a celibate, going to mature in love, I have to be generative. That's what maturity is about. That's what you see in grandmas and grandpas often. You have to be able... Generative meaning life-giving. So they are able to spend their life in creative communion, which is life-giving, both to themselves and to those to whom they relate. I hope you'd agree with that. That's the goal, to be able to give life. Well, the psychologists tell us, I'm sure they're right, you may have a different opinion, that to be generative, a person must experience intimacy. I don't mean sexual intimacy, but intimacy. Without intimacy, you can't become generative. And intimacy, I define here, as the kind of loving and being loved which is experienced as the fruit of being deeply known and accepted by another whom we know and accept intimately. If you don't know me and you say, oh, gee, you're a good priest, it doesn't help me much. Because I can say, oh, well, you just don't know me. You know, do you know what I mean? It's nice to be complimented rather than to be put down, but it isn't actually that much of a help, because I know you don't know me. Get it? There has to be people in, I'm saying my, but you know what I mean, there has to be people in my life who really know me and who surprise me by loving me and say, you're doing well, you're loving well. Well, I find that really helpful, don't you? If someone says it to you, that's intimacy. Because intimacy demands that the person knows you and that you know they know you. And you know them. And I hope there's one person in this world. If you've got two, you're very lucky. If you've got three, you're bloody cooking with gas, as they say. But because it's very rare to have someone, but someone who really knows you. It can be a spiritual director. It can be a parent. Not all parents really know their children. It can be an uncle. It can be a close friend. It can be a religious sister that wanders around. It can be someone in hospital. Heavens, it can be you. Really knowing someone and listening to them and loving who they really are. That's intimacy. Without that, a person can't become generative. That's the tragedy of life. Some people may have never known intimacy. And the third point of this logic, to be truly intimate, one must have a sense of one's own identity. So there's a stage growth here. I have to be in touch with myself. Otherwise, now I'll just speak as a priest who tries to listen to people over many years. I have continually found, and you'd understand this, and you would too, I guess, but I'll just say, I've continually found people whom I get to know them and I see their real beauty, and show that I see it, I guess, or say it at times when it's appropriate, people find it so hard to believe. Because in their mind, and you can see it, they're saying, oh, but he doesn't really know me, or he's being nice because he's a priest. Do you get it? He's being nice because he's a nice person. And you're not. You're being nice because you've seen something beautiful. But we're all a bit resistant. Well, we, human beings, strike me as, on the whole, pretty resistant to compliments. Because we know what's going on, and we know how complex we are, and we know how stumbling we are, and we all see that, because we've got ideals and we're not... Okay, so... Identity, you've got to be in touch with who you really are to some extent, and more, but this is an ongoing thing. So if I'm aware that I'm Michael, say, and I'm in touch with my own identity, and you're intimate with me, meaning really loving and truthful and whatever, and there's an intimacy there, you can see, can't you? That nourishes me. Nourishes me. Not the person I think you know who isn't me, but me. And then I can become generative in every whatever way it happens to be. A sense of self, this experience is being affirmed by a person who is, they talk about the significant other. This is where parents are so vital, but everyone can be part of this. Sense of self, some significant person. It can be a teacher. And actually it can be one person. Teachers have got a wonderful responsibility in this life, because sometimes the teacher is the one who actually knows you better than anybody. And teachers have such a privilege. They can get to know so many children, knowing them, and the kids know they know them, and you can really do something marvelous with them, of course. Most people find themselves and experience intimacy through a graced sexual union. That's the fact. Some are graced to find themselves and experience intimacy as celibate. I hope you know priests and nuns and brothers and celibate men and women in the community who are very able to be intimate and very generative of love. I know plenty. So I suppose you know plenty. Because they've got this gift. It is a gift. It's an unusual gift, but it's there. It's the virtue of chastity which both for the married and the unmarried keeps pure the experience of being sexual. Chastity is the virtue. And most people are chaste in marriage, because they've got this sexual union, which is very demanding and very beautiful. Some are able to be chaste as a single man or woman. None of us are single, we all belong to everybody, but you know what I mean, without a sexual partner. And that's the key that has to be assessed. And when you're in a position of formation, as I've been in a seminary, that's what you're looking for. You're not looking for somebody who can manage to be pure. Do you know what I mean? They might be pure by being really rigid and really tight, and they may be doing their best, and they may be remaining very... But they're not free, they're not flying, their wings aren't flapping, and they're not loving. Well, if someone's not loving, what do you... You don't leave them in where they're dying of thirst. You help them find a place where they can find love, don't you? Please nod so I know you agree with me. I think that's what we do with people. And lastly, still on the celibacy, and I believe Paul is consistent with this. The only reason I know for being celibate, truly, and the only reason I've ever thought of with others as well of being celibate, I wouldn't even bother trying if Jesus wasn't. But the fact is that Jesus seems to have loved pretty well. And wouldn't you agree? And if Jesus was celibate, it makes me think it's possible. Now, it'll only be possible with special grace, and we won't all do it as beautifully as him, and we'll make mistakes, and we'll fumble, and we'll have to find work, you know, like everything, like marriages have to grow, celibacy has to grow too. So there'll be stumbling on the way, and fumbling, and mistakes, and hurt, and we just minimise, but whatever happens to human beings, we're watching Jesus who inspires this. And thank God, I know plenty of celibate priests in my own order who are just beautiful, loving people. So they encourage me to think it could happen to me. So it's about that. It's about a celibate wishes to respond to Jesus with the same celibate love which Jesus has for him or her. So this is a prayer thing. You can't go past it. It's a mystical thing. It's a love thing. Celibate love casts into sharp relief the mystery of communion in love with God. I think this is true. You could say if you didn't, but I think it is. I think as a priest, and I know why the church is, I don't agree with this, that I don't agree, so what? I think the church is making a major mistake in limiting priests to those who are judged to be celibate. We haven't got enough priests. It's hurting the church badly, but obviously the Pope doesn't agree, and if you've got a side between me and the Pope, for God's sake, listen to the Pope. But I'm just saying it does seem to me not to be a very sensible system at the moment, because leadership hasn't always been celibate and needn't be celibate. It can be many other ways as well. So, and celibacy is a gift, and it's once you get a gift and put it into a system and structure it, you get all the problems of boys, 12 and a half I was when I first went to the apostolic school and lived a celibate life. You know, well, okay, well, I didn't meet a girl really till I was 25, and then I met her when I had a big cassock on, you know. That's pretty dangerous stuff, really. And I'm not surprised that some didn't make the journey successfully. But some did, and I don't regret one minute of my life in the seminary. It was just beautiful, and I loved the study, and I loved the prayer, and I had wise directors, and I could write a love story about the seminary for you if you wanted me to, and I would. Some didn't find it as good as that. It depends on temperament. So no regrets about it, but I hope you can see that when I get ordained at 24, there's a lot I don't know. Lot I haven't experienced. And if you're not psychologically pretty well established through your family, you're going to perhaps make pretty serious errors. And you might also be a very good person who's trying really hard to be good, but you're not in a real world, an ordinary world. And when you get into the ordinary world, you may break psychically. Okay, so there's all that to say. But it's this hope, this... people who come, why I see it fits so well, is people who come to a priest, I think, in a sense, they don't feel, if a priest is also celibate, they don't feel they're intruding into your privacy, they're not intruding into your love life, they're not intruding into your family. Whether we do it or not, but the aim is that you, the person you love most as a celibate is the person that's there with you. And they can know that. Do you know what I mean? Because you're not... there's someone else you love most, and they're... and I'm not... you know I'm not knocking married priests. That isn't what I'm saying at all. That's the very thing I don't want to say. I can just see why celibacy and priesthood do fit well together, because you're everybody's father or everyone's brother or everyone's lover in that sense. And it is a beautiful gift to go with priesthood for that reason. Everyone, however, is called to holiness... and all are called, as we'll see in a moment in Paul, to love God with an undivided heart. We're all called to that. Married, celibate, etc. True love doesn't distract from love for Christ. Obviously, in fact, married love is a sacrament of that love. And that's a pretty high thing to say about it. This is true of love for spouse, for children. It's true of those who forego marriage, love to devote themselves to Christ and his mission, highlight the power of Christ's love and their wholehearted dedication to this love. They draw their love directly from the heart of Christ. In my generation, there were plenty of young girls who became nuns, religious sisters, and our church has just been so blessed with them. I mean, there'd be individual ones who psychologically broke down and too much was asked of them, and that happens in every field of life. So, but the vast bulk of them are just wonderful women. Today, no young woman thinks of becoming a religious sister. And in 10 years' time, we're all going to wake up and look at our church and think, my God, what we've lost. This feminine devotion to people in schools and hospitals and parishes and just care for orphanage. It's just astonishing. And when you think 99% of it was just so pure and beautiful, it's tragic if those who broke down under the pressure become kind of blamed as though the whole system was somehow bad. And that would be cruel and wrong, but it happens, and we just live with that. So that's my best offering to you of something to do with why Paul is encouraging celibacy. There are other reasons which will come clear in a moment. And I'll just do one more thing, and then I'll have a break. Now he addresses himself to married believers. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. So this is getting into about moral, this is bong, this is central stuff. This is Jesus' stuff. I give this command, and it comes from Jesus himself, the risen Christ, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Please, no, don't forget, he's not talking to married people, he's talking to married believers. He's talking to a man and a woman who both believe. That's critical to this whole thing. And be careful, because what we've done in our organized church is we have associated, or in fact identified, belief with baptism. Very dangerous connection. People can be baptized at 1 year old by no one who brings them up in any faith at all, and they've never believed, you know? Well, you know that. So a person might have a baptism certificate and be an unbeliever. Please note Paul's words. He's talking to two adults who are both believers and who've said, I love you no matter what. I give myself to you forever, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer. And they've both done it in faith. How often that happens, I'm not here to say, but it mightn't happen terribly often. And I know it often doesn't happen, even with the best will in the world. So with two believers like that, Paul says, no, you've made a promise here in faith to each other that goes right back to the heart of God, and you've trusted yourself to another person, you've trusted your future to her or to him, you've given this, and you're a symbol, in fact a sacrament, you go on to say in Ephesians, but you're a sacrament of the love of Christ. So if you take that love away, you're getting right in there and hurting that person. You're taking Christ's love away. You could be appearing to the person, do you see? Like, it's a really sacred thing. So you shouldn't do it. And if you do separate, well, remain unmarried or come back to your husband. And a husband shouldn't divorce his wife. He says it's from the Lord. I'm going to talk about it after the break a little bit more subtly, but there it is. This is Paul, Jesus' statement in Luke, who often gives us the words of Jesus pretty raw, so the scholars say, the others that can adapt them a little. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. That's Jesus' words as given by Luke. Notice they're only addressed to the man. But remember that in the Jewish situation, only the man could divorce. It was, they just didn't enter Jesus' head, if you like. It was in nobody's mind that a woman could divorce husbands, because you couldn't. So he's addressing himself to the man. But when you read Mark, who's writing in Rome, in a Gentile situation, where you can, a woman could divorce her husband, and by the way, Paul's writing in Corinth, where all they had to do was, if I was your husband, I just had to give you a slip of paper. I'm divorced. See you later. It wasn't even a year. You just divorce. Either of them, just by will. Can you imagine how stable marriages were in Corinth? They are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Jesus' words, as in Mark. That's all that Luke says. He doesn't give this setting. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. That's quite beautiful. Against her. Okay? And she, if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So that's, you see, Mark is applying Jesus' words to a Roman situation. Matthew adds a rider to it. Matthew doesn't put it as bluntly as that, because Matthew's living, the gospel is probably written in Syria, in Antioch, that's highly likely. And in Antioch, he's writing within a Jewish setting, and he has to, as we all have to do, take Jesus' words, but get to the principle behind the words and apply them intelligently. So in there he says, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another is guilty of adultery. But he adds a rider in that you don't find in Mark and don't find in Luke. And it is, I'm not speaking of porneia. Now, how do you translate that? It used to be pronounced, I'm not speaking of fornication. And some have interpreted that to mean if a person is unfaithful to the marriage, then you may divorce her or him. Do you get it? The recent thing, and there's a whole lot of reasons for this I won't go into now because I'm not doing Matthew, the New Jerusalem Bible translates it, I think, accurately as, I'm not speaking of illicit marriages. Porneia was also used for zanut in Hebrew, which meant, I'm not talking about people living together that aren't married according to the social customs of the Jewish world. I'm talking about people who are really married. And that's the qualification he makes there, which of course you'd need to make. So what have we come to? Paul's looking at this whole question of thing, and he said to married couples who are believers from the Lord, don't become celibate. It's okay, it's a good thing to be celibate, but not for you, because you too, do you get me? You can't separate, or if you do, you might divorce. No, you don't have to divorce to become a Christian, because some of them were saying, oh look, I've got to leave marriage alone, it's all a very messy, I've got to become pure to be with God. And he's saying, no, wait a minute. And he's bringing them back to basics and supporting marriage as a sexual relationship, human relationship, which is begets love.